Okay, let's get started on episode four then. I think today, the big conversation is going to be around life sciences recruitment in 2025.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the key for me is let's look back a little bit first of all and think about what happened in so far this in year 2024 has been a bit of a disaster, I think, for a lot of companies.
I'm not looking back with rose-tinted glasses, that's for sure.
No, I think a lot of people have found it difficult. I mean, especially recruitment companies, where they've, you know, not necessarily prepared properly for this type of environment. So I keep saying to a lot of people, it's the worst year I've ever seen in 28 years in the industry now, in total. I don't think I've ever seen it as quiet. I've never seen the economy as bad. You know, we've had a political situation, not only Europe and the UK, but also the US all at the same time, all of which have affected everything. And it's been really hard for people. I mean, you must have seen it yourself.
Absolutely. So I think, particularly recruitment agencies, let's start there, right? I think the really, really big ones that do absolutely everything, you know, let's think your sort of heavy hitter blockbuster recruitment agencies. Yes, they've made some cuts. Yes, they've had to downsize teams. They've had to sort of close down certain desks, but they're all still there. You know, they're all still getting through it. And I think they're doing a really good job given the situation they're in. But also the really small, incredibly niche, less than 10 people agencies that work in one specific corner of the industry. I think some of them have done really well as well. But anyone that falls in between those two extremes, I think, has had a really rough year.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. I mean, especially when you think about the sort of the clinical research side of things, which is, you know, one of our biggest areas. You know, people have really struggled. And I think the CROs have struggled as well, because we know that, you know, that at the beginning of the year, they were struggling to actually get to where they wanted to be on their targets. They all seem to have done their targets now, or some companies have actually done better. But a lot of that work has still not been released. So, you know, you might have won the contracts, but unless you can actually start them, it's very difficult. And if they don't start them, and if the pharma companies, biotechs don't give them the work because they can't afford to start them, you sort of go into this spiral of, you know, waiting, and it becomes a waiting pattern for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, and it's quite
that's expensive.
Well, it is when you're benching people, you know, or you're having to try and do something else with that workforce that you've got. So it's quite troublesome, I think, when you're thinking about financial planning, especially if you're, you know, one of the big CROs and you've got thousands of people that you need to deploy, or you need thousands of people, but you don't know when. So it must be a nightmare. I wouldn't like to do it, that's for sure. But
thankfully, it's nearly over now.
It is nearly over. We have started to see a bit of growth. Let's face it, especially if you look at geographically worldwide. We know the US is slowing down. It's been slowing down for a little while. I think now the election's over, we'll start to see that picking up. So that's good. I know California has always stayed fairly positive and buoyant, but the rest of the US seems to have sort of just flatlined, really, just passing time. But it has led to a lot of the US companies sort of looking elsewhere. So we know a lot of them are looking at Europe. We know a lot of them are looking at expanding into Latin. Africa seems to be picking up, which is interesting. And obviously in EMEA, you've got a huge amount of money's gone from governments to try and win more clinical trials into their own countries.
Spain's a success story of 2024, in my opinion.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, they put their money where their mouth was, and it's worked. You know, France has been good. The Nordics have been good, weirdly. You know, they picked up a few. We've got Portugal has done well. Bulgaria has done well. Eastern Europe generally has done pretty well as well.
But the one that surprised,
the one that surprised me the most was Latin, though. So I think everything's settling down in Mexico. I thought Colombia would have gone bigger, but it's that's sort of stabilised at the minute. Brazil's looking good, so you know, obviously they've got a few political issues down there as well. But so we are starting to see some sort of growth trickling through, and it's all going to depend on, you know, political situation and whether the farmers and the biotechs start to release the trials, which then gets everything going, because that affects everything, you know, medical writing, marketing, you know, manufacturing, everything is all reliant on those things. But I think it's all going to come back. I think it's just timing more than anything else.
Your timing and the political landscape. Obviously, politics, 2024 has been such a big year for politics. You know, we had obviously the UK general election, and that had a result that not all of us expected. We had the US election, and that had a result that not everyone expected. And then also the European election, the European Parliament. So that result seems to... They seem to have addressed the fact that life sciences in Europe isn't where they wanted it to be. And the data suggesting they've lost about 6% of clinical trials over the last 10 years, which, you know, it doesn't sound like much, but when you consider how many used to take place, that's a huge figure, and they want them back. So they've said that they're going to invest in making life sciences a more European staple again. So that's quite interesting, at least. Little bits of pledging from the UK budget as well. There were little nods to life sciences and particularly biotech growth. So that's a good sign. What about the US? You've been reading up on that, haven't you?
Yeah, well, the US, I think the problem is it's getting so expensive to actually work in the US. And, you know, it's actually expensive to live there, to be honest, as well. And, you know, you get these bio hubs, and in the bio hubs, it's always expensive there.
So you're
sort of going around in a circle, which is why I think a lot of the bigger companies are looking at expanding into EMEA, looking at Australia. They're looking at India, Asia Pac generally. And as I said, you know, we've actually seen a lot of activity in South Africa. And I think a lot of that is to get more regional-based clinical trials rather than, you know, 60-year-old men with bald heads doing most of the clinical trials.
Sure.
You know, those days are gone, you know. So.
It's good to get a bit more diversity in what we're doing. You know, I was reading something the other day. It was, women were only involved in clinical trials from 1993. I didn't realise it was that recent. When you think of how long we've had clinical trials for, it's good to see that they're diversifying, and that's going to give us some interesting data.
I think women have always been there, but it's a relatively, or has been in the past, a relatively small group. And I think this is what people are saying. You know, you can't just have clinical trials on one type of person. You've got to go broader than that and wider,
and show
global. You know,
for sure.
But the other thing that I think we've seen a lot of this year is the, I think the industry just being leaner, you know, meaner, cleaner, greener, all those types of things, which is causing a problem because you can only do so much with what you've got. And I think a lot of companies have been under pressure to sort of change the way they work.
Yeah, I would agree.
I think we've certainly seen that from, well, two points of view, you know, because obviously we deal with a lot of talent acquisition people. There's a lot of recruitment out there that's sort of gone stale to a certain extent. You know, companies that were doing really well, and even though they are still doing well, have actually stopped recruiting because they're all sitting there not quite sure what to do. So it's, you know, what can you do with less? I know this is one of your areas, so what are you seeing?
It's really, really difficult. So if we're kind of jumping into that section, I guess the thing that a lot of people I'm speaking to are suffering with is recruitment's become more competitive than probably ever. You know, there's a lot more companies all after the same people. But from above, they're being given very limited resources to achieve that goal. So they've got to be a little bit smarter. And, you know, if with the right applications of the right tools, it's possible. So let's look at LinkedIn's AI hiring feature, right? It looks really, really good in theory, in principle. You know, we haven't had a whole lot of time to play with it and get to know the nuances yet. But in principle, this is going to save the average recruiter time in terms of sourcing, in terms of verifying, in terms of making sure that they've got a decent pipeline of interesting talent to present to their clients. What they've now got to learn to do is not necessarily do that, but more of it, but it's differentiate themselves to make themselves competitive as a recruiter and make sure they keep that bum on the seat where they want to work. So investing in soft skills. I think the things that we said are going to be really important are things like data analysis, leadership, communication skills, those kind of things that are not necessarily part of a bog standard recruiter's job, but they need to develop them, you know, if they want to keep that job relevant to the to 2025. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was looking at this with a number of clients, and I've been involved in a number of awards this year, so I've started to see a change already. So a change in management, how do you manage, you know, millennials, Gen Z, Gen X, et cetera, et cetera, and how do you make the most out of that work pool? And it's a very different workforce to what we've ever dealt with before, and it's the way that I'm seeing things at the moment, it's all going to skills-based development. So a business now needs to look at the skills they need within the organization to move forward. And sometimes that'll mean reskilling or upskilling existing people, because guess what? You know, keeping your own people is much better than losing them and having to replace them. Because if you're buying in, it's nearly twice as much. So I think they're looking at, you know, where are people going? What's their skill base? What skills do we need? Especially with these new technologies that are coming out, do we need the same people we used to, or do we need to change? I know that there's a couple of companies I work with quite closely that have completely changed the way that they work. And that's from the top down, from a management structure.
Yeah.
You know, they've changed the way that they see the world. And I think that's what a lot of companies have been trying to do, although some are scared to do it. You know, it's a bit of a chasm to cross, really. And obviously the other thing is, when you're looking at workforces now, it seems like salary expectation, work-life balance. Do I work in the office? Do I work from home? You know, it's all about me. What do I want to do? And if I don't like it, you know, people can actually just go and do something else. And you still see that a lot, you know?
It's true, but I think the return to office agenda is still there. I think a lot of companies are still asking people to come back as much as full-time as possible and be in the office. A lot of companies feel like their culture has suffered. A lot of them have got the desire to have a full office because for their other portfolios, that makes sense. There's a lot of reasons to have your team all together in one place. And I think that there will always be a push for that, particularly from, you know, the sort of baby boomer generation who are at the C-suite, who that's what they're used to. They don't like having a half empty office. It doesn't feel right, you know? So I think that there's going to be a push for that. At the moment, I think it's 76% of workers are hybrid.
Yeah.
Which is a huge figure. And, you know, that works. Hybrid is a nice thing. It's an agreed upon term where a fixed amount in, a fixed amount out. And I think that works. What do you think?
No, I agree. I mean, I think the problem you've got is, you know, dare I say it, and can't think of a better way of saying it, people have tasted that great freedom of being able to work from home now. And it's going to be very, very hard to convince them to go back to the office.
Yeah.
However, a lot of this that we're seeing at the moment, there's a lot of issues around anxiety. There's a lot of issues around pressure of work. So well-being is becoming really important. And when you're looking at socializing, I've seen a lot of companies now doing things like, you know, walk and talk. You know, when they're having Teams calls, you've got to have your camera on. You can't be doing anything else. You've got to be fully engaged in the meeting.
Yeah, let me see your hands, that whole thing.
Yeah. And it's things like micro promotions that are given. But the biggest ones for me is like things like development roadmaps. So that development roadmap might say that, you know, okay, this is your job is no longer linear. You just don't go from A to B. You might go from A to C to D to E, then back to B, depending on where your career is going. So, you know, if you want to go more into management, there's opportunities there if you've got the skills to actually do it. If you want to be a subject matter lead, you can do that. But you don't have to follow a linear route. And what I'm starting to see with a lot of companies is they're starting to think more about mentoring. So with the baby boomers that are retiring, they're trying to retain them and say, look, you know, can you work, you know, part time for a year and help bring up some younger people, you know, share your knowledge before you do retire rather than just going. And I think that's a really good idea because mentoring is not just about, you know, being mentored by someone who's already in a role or in a more senior than you. Sometimes it's people that have got different skills. Sometimes it might be, you know, depending on what your personal situation is, a mentor from home or from outside of the business. If you've got good people, they're worth keeping and they're worth putting the effort into. So we're starting to see a lot of that as well, you know?
I think, and that's a really, really good point. We spoke a minute ago about the skills that people are going to need to develop to be competitive. And these aren't necessarily skills that you can just do a module on and learn. Like, you know, the older generations, generally, they've got the leadership skills. They've got the communication skills because they don't come from an age where everything's been on a phone screen. They've got these skills that us younger generation need to develop, particularly within talent acquisition and recruitment. You know, if you want to take someone who's just out of university, they've gone straight into a recruitment job at one of the big boys, and they are learning how to do recruitment there, they've got to develop themselves to be a better recruiter or talent acquisition professional, and they're not going to learn those jobs anywhere except from someone much older with much more world experience who can teach them. If they don't have that, they're doomed. I think mentoring is going to be incredibly important.
Yeah, I mean, I recently was lucky enough to be picked as a judge for the Marketing Awards for Pharma Times. And it was one of those ones where I went along thinking, well, you know, I've seen these sort of things before, you know, some people are good, some bad, and, you know, it's hard work. But the two teams that actually came into the finals were so good. They were outstanding, well-trained, well-mentored, knew what they had to do, all had leadership skills, all were clever, knew what they wanted to achieve. You know, they worked out what they needed to do within 10 minutes of being there. And it was a day session. It was like, you know, going through The Apprentice. And I was so impressed, and actually walked away from that thinking, you know what? Wow,
it's incredible.
And I haven't felt like that for a long time. You know, some companies are getting this absolutely right, and I was delighted. So, so we are starting to see things changing. But going back to talent acquisition, I think the other thing that I'm seeing a lot of growth in is the RPOs. I think they're all sort of gearing up to looking to cover shortfalls in talent acquisition where they get peaks and troughs. Because it's okay when you're running the day-to-day, but all of a sudden if you win a big piece of business and you need to recruit, you know, 200 people, 400 people, 1,000 people, that's when the operation starts to go a little bit awry. So I think there's a bridging the gap or helping and supporting the organisation for 6 months while they get over a particular project. I think we're seeing a lot more of that, and I see a lot more of that globally as well, depending on the needs of the business.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because when I think of RPOs, I generally think of ebbs and flows. You know, when we speak to the big pharma companies, the big CROs, the big biotechs, they go through the motions with RPOs. They'll use them for a year, then they'll get a talent acquisition team, then they'll do something else, and then they're up with a different RPO. I'm starting to see them seeing the value of RPO a lot more, as well as smaller recruitment companies going, we offer RPO services too. And I think there is way more of a push to that being the model moving forward.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, I was thinking a little bit, you know, it goes a little bit with this as well, about what we were saying about AI earlier. And I think AI is great. Don't get me wrong. We need it. I mean, there's lots of tools out there. I've got a sheet in front of me with about 40 of them on there of things that people are using. But you still need to have a person there to actually use them, to make sure they're being used properly, to still put human interaction between those tools. So, you know, it's not the be-all and end-all with AI, but they're going to make a big difference time-wise. I mean, I think the when I was looking at one of the reports from one of the management consultancies recently, they were saying that, you know, AI is going to reduce talent acquisition teams by about 25% because, you know, you're just going to not need that amount of people. How long that takes, I don't know, because, you know, things move quite quickly. You know, what's the latest new thing? You want the latest new things, you've got to retrain on that. By the time you finish retraining on that, there's another new thing, you've got to retrain on that one as well. So you're sort of constantly playing catch-up. You know, have you seen much of that?
100%, yeah. And I think that one thing that life sciences isn't particularly good at is sticking to a long-term plan. I think that's something that we could all do way better. Much like what I said about RPOs a minute ago, you know, they'll go, right, here's what we're going to do. They'll get a year into that idea and get, oh, I don't like it. Now we're going to do something else. And then they'll get a new CEO who will come in and go, we're taking a whole different direction, guys. We're going this way. Mm. They don't give themselves enough time to bed into an idea and get really good at any one thing. So I don't know if it's going to be as threatening as we thought it was going to be about two and a half years ago, when it was all the rage, you know, AI is coming, look busy.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, though, with AI, I think the thing that we'll all start to rely on, which I think is a good thing, is we're going to have huge amounts of data.
Yes.
For the first time ever, we're going to be able to actually look at something and say, you know, what was the return on investment on what we've just done? And it's not just someone finger in the air saying, oh, yeah, I thought that was really good. Show me the data. Show me how it's, you know, affected the business. What's the return on investment? And where do we go next? So I think we're going to see a lot more of that. And not only in running businesses, but in talent acquisition, in HR, everything's going to be monitored, including your workforce. And that data will then dictate where you go in the future. And I think that's a really good thing because it takes away the guesswork. Yeah, you've actually got something tangible to actually look at and make decisions based on the performance of those things. You know, so I think that's going to be good from an AI point of view. And I think I'm already starting to see bits and pieces of that happening. So that's been good.
Yeah, 100%. And it goes back to what we were saying back in episode 2, upskilling and reskilling. Data analytics is going to be an incredibly important part of anyone's role moving forward if they want to stay, what's the word I'm looking for, admirable, wanted in a labour market. It's a skill that you have to develop and you have to get good at. You know, and I'm and just nailing it home, I think, with that point. If you want to get good at this, get friendly with data like now, because you'll become one of the most desired recruiters in the industry.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I mean, just to sort of round up on this podcast, what's your view moving forward?
I mean, doing more with less is very much the theme. I think a lot of recruiters that I speak to are used to having all the tools on the planet. You know, they've got LinkedIn, they've got accounts with Indeed and Total Jobs and Farmyweb and everything in between. And now they've been told, hey, LinkedIn bill's gone up by 50%. You've got to pick some platforms to lose. And they've gone, oh no, I don't want to do that. Okay, I'll pick these three. What do I do now? So they've got to get really, really smart with the tools that they do have and making sure they're utilizing them to the fullest. You know, if they've kept a generic job board and Indeed, a generic job board and LinkedIn, they've got to make sure that they are utilizing that job board to the fullest. They've got to have things like CV alerts set up. They've got to have job scraping in place, offloading all of that monotonous work that takes time. Otherwise, the return on investment's not going to be there. And next time LinkedIn puts their price up, all of their other tools are going to go. If they don't start using them and allocating to the right source, they're not going to have a tech stack next year. It is just going to be LinkedIn dominating everything. So I think they've got to get smart what they do have and use it.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of companies have got tech stacks that they don't actually use. And I think,
oh, my gosh.
That'll come to the fore very quickly. From my point of view, I think for all companies, your employee value proposition, your employer brand is going to become absolutely essential.
Yeah.
I think retention of your workforce, especially if they're good, you know, keep them, because if you've trained them, if they like the company, you know, all of those things are really, really important. And then using internal mobility to keep them interested in the job. You know, I think younger people now get bored doing the same old thing. They're not going to do the same job for 10 years.
Yeah,
best, they're probably going to do 2.5 years. So internal mobility, get them trained up, get them moved on, keep their skills coming, keep training them, get them doing different things, make them more rounded and more useful to the organisation rather than just this A to B job. You know, that's gone. I think people need to wake up to that. Overall, I think the other thing with IT and the systems that we use now, especially when people are not in the office, is communication.
Mm.
Humans talk to each other, for God's sake. It makes a big difference. You know, to stop sending emails when you could have just picked up the phone and said, how are you today? How's it going? What are you working on? Do you need any help with anything?
Yeah,
it's not a big thing, because younger people are not having it. They don't have that level of contact that we used to. And I think all organisations need to pick up their game on that.
Yeah.
Be a human. Talk to another human. Don't just send electronic messages or text messages or whatever it is you're doing. Actually talk to someone. Even if it's 5 minutes. It makes a huge difference. And it makes someone's day sometimes, because they might not see anyone all week.
It does. Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it's true. I remember going back to, you know, peak lockdown. you've got to think of people, you've got to be human, and you've got to ask people. So yeah, I think that's a good thing to leave it at, you know. Finish the podcast, pick up a phone, call a work friend.
Wouldn't that be nice if people did?
It's true.
Okay, thanks, Simon. I think
nice one, Vince. Yeah.
See you soon.
Chat to you next time.
Okay, bye.